In 1860, the French explorer Henri Mouhot made a stunning announcement. He had discovered a lost civilization in present-day Cambodia, the remains of a sophisticated megacity that by the 10th century had a population that ran well into the thousands. Never mind that the city was never exactly lost to locals or that the civilization that thrived in its heyday was alive and well, this seemingly abandoned metropolis helped feed Western fantasies about undiscovered worlds of the ancient past. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Such discoveries would startle and fascinate us in part because they are gone or appear to be. We wonder how a place so large could exist for many centuries only to disappear from view. The loss of these ancient destinations happened for various reasons, but as my guest has learned, the things they had in common carry lessons for modern civilization, a toxic combination of poor leadership and environmental disaster. Annalee Newitz is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, a founder of IO9, and former editor-in-chief of Gizmodo. Their new book is called Four Lost Cities, A Secret History of the Urban Age. Annalee, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
All right, I want to start with this much-loved trope in Western culture of lost cities. How and why does it get in the way of understanding how civilizations come to an end?
Yeah, I think we have this love of the apocalypse. And so whenever we, you know, come across ruins that suggest that there's been a great city somewhere or a great town, you know, the first place our minds go is it must have just been completely destroyed. It's completely gone. And we fail to see the ways in which ancient civilizations have transformed and have a lot of continuity with the modern day. And so what a lot of the archaeologists I talk to for the book prefer to talk about is civilizational transformation and looking at how we may move from one place to another. We may abandon a city, but that doesn't mean that that city is lost. And it certainly doesn't mean that the accomplishments of that civilization are lost.
In fact, these places, none of them Pompeii's maybe a little bit of an exception, but they don't vanish overnight, right? I mean, people make choices over many generations to go away from them.
That's right. And I think one of the really interesting parts of this research is thinking about lost cities in the context of all of the personal choices that people made in those cities to leave them and why they did it. And as you said, in all these cases, I look at four different cities and they are abandoned over a period of a century or more. And generally it's because the infrastructure isn't being taken care of. The people who are in leadership positions, who have the means to pay a workforce or force a workforce to repair the city, start kind of focusing on their own internal problems, that politics become unstable, the leaders become uninterested in helping the people who are in fact building the city. And so people start leaving. You know, they feel like there's less opportunity, or they notice that the streets aren't repaired and the waterways are full of silt. And so once one group of people starts leaving, it has this very slow snowball effect. So, you know, if you can imagine a snowball that lasts for 100 years, gradually getting smaller and smaller, because the more that people leave a city, the less able the city is maintaining itself. You know, the city, you know, the workers are leaving. The city's roads are even less in repair, which makes even more people want to leave. And then their friends are leaving, and so they want to leave. And so really what we see is this weird situation in these cities where if you were living in them during the period of abandonment, you might not even notice. You know, you might say, well, there's a few less opportunities, a few of my neighbors are gone, but you wouldn't necessarily say the end is nigh, you know, everybody leave.
Yeah, it made me think, reading this book, I was thinking about Detroit, a place that was, it is still very much a city. People are trying to take care of it and bring it back, but it was definitely stronger and more powerful half a century ago.
That is very true. And I think people bring up Detroit a lot or St. Louis when they think about cities that have been kind of economic powerhouses and are now being slowly abandoned. But, you know, one of the hopeful things that I learned in researching this book is that, you know, cities don't always you know, disappear once people start abandoning them. Revitalization efforts in cities go back thousands of years. And they're not necessarily conscious and deliberate revitalization efforts like we see in a lot of modern cities, but people will sometimes start to abandon a city and then new people will come or new leadership will come in and they will rebuild the city differently. This is something that happened at the ancient city of Cahokia, which is located outside of St. Louis. It was an indigenous city that was very active about 1,000 years ago. And what we see in the remains of the city as archaeologists dig down is that there were two or three different kinds of city grids over time, and that clearly people kind of rejected one version of the city and then rebuilt it to look different and to suit their needs better. And so we know that a place like Detroit, there's no fated end for Detroit. Detroit could easily turn things around and become a really different kind of city and last for many hundreds of years. We just don't know.
Cahokia is a really interesting place because there are depictions sometimes in textbooks of what it might have looked like. The folks there built these really large mounds and they built ceremonial areas. But you know that the mounds are always depicted with like some little grass growing over them, and they almost certainly didn't look that way.
Yeah, I mean, I love that idea of a really grassy green city, but these were urban places. And so when you think about, you know, at the heart of Cahokia in their kind of downtown area, there was a massive earthen pyramid that had a footprint about the size of the Great Pyramid at Giza. So give you an idea, it's huge. And it would have dominated the skyline. And indeed, it would not have had grass on it. It would have looked like packed earth. You know, it may have had, we don't know, it may have had designs on it. It may have had different colored clay. We do know that the people at Cahokia loved to use multicolored clay to kind of create, you know, an artistic feeling or a spiritual image. But the whole city is packed with these mounds. It's really, it looks terraformed, like someone came along and just, you know, built this huge sprawling space for humans. And, you know, yeah, it would have been muddy. It would have been full of, you know, houses and smoke and, you know, all the things we think of as urban were going on in the Americas for thousands of years before Europeans got here.
And the permanent residents of Cahokia catered to a kind of tourist pilgrimage industry?
It's true. You see this in a lot of ancient cities. You know, we have this idea in, you know, the modern world that cities are places for trade, right? You know, because we live in a capitalist society. And so we immediately think like, well, where's the marketplace? You know, where can I go buy some shoes or buy a cloak or whatever you're going to buy 1,000 years ago? But actually, cities like Cahokia were ceremonial centers. People came there, not to put too fine a point on it, they came there to party. And, you know, there were different periods of the year where there were festivals. And Cahokia is at a branch in the Mississippi, between the Mississippi and the Missouri rivers. And they shared cultural identity with a lot of settlements all up and down the Mississippi River. And so at certain times of year, when Cahokia was having festival season, people came from as far away as Florida, all the way up the Mississippi to visit. And they would have huge barbecues and ceremonies and hang out with their friends. And so the city really grew and shrank with the seasons, like a tourist town. But it also had, even year round, it had a very significant population. It was about 30,000 people, 20 to 30,000 people, roughly the size of Paris in France around the same time. So, you know, about 1,000 years ago, it would rival Paris for its spectacle and population.
But it was gone by the time Europeans showed up, and so they assumed there was nothing in our part of North America that sort of rivaled the great cities of antiquity in Europe.
I mean, I think there were a lot of reasons why Europeans thought that. I think anyone who had done any kind of exploring in North America at the time that Cahokia was discovered, or quote unquote discovered, people were living there. The Cahokia tribe was living there, and you know, there are a lot of these massive earthworks throughout the South. You know, if you've ever driven past a town called Mounds or Moundville, there's a ton of towns like that all along the Mississippi. And those are places where people had built mounds because they were part of the Mississippian culture, or they were part of even earlier cultures. We have huge mounds and earthworks going back about 5,000 years. There's one in Louisiana that's this massive earthwork that clearly was built by people. It wasn't an accident. So I think that, you know, partly it was that Europeans didn't understand what this was and maybe couldn't imagine it as a city, but partly it was that they were white settlers. They wanted to come in and kind of take over the land. And it was a convenient myth to say, well, no one's really been here. You know, no one's using this land. And even if they are using it, well, they're not using it for building big, cool cities like we're going to build. But in fact, they just they missed out on all the, you know, the signs of what truly had been here and what was here.
All right. If Cahokia didn't exactly collapse, how and why did its population disperse over time?
Yeah, this is one of the big mysteries in archaeology. There's a lot of hypotheses. We do know that it would have been, like many cities, the abandonment was slow, and the city went through a couple phases of revitalization before that happened. But there are a lot of indications that Cahokia may have been built with the idea that the city would ultimately be abandoned. I think the European tradition and the Western tradition, we think of cities as things that could last forever. When we build cities, we don't think, well, this is just temporary. You know, we'll throw up a couple skyscrapers, no biggie. There's this idea that, like, this is a monument that will last for, you know, thousands and thousands of years. And there's some evidence from oral histories from indigenous cultures in the area that there was a different approach to urbanism and a different approach to settlement, and that people who built Cahokia may very well have thought of it as something incredible and magnificent that never was intended to last for longer than even a generation or a few generations. And there are many, there's a lot of evidence of rituals that took place within the city where people engaged in something that archaeologists call deliberate abandonment, where they build something, build a house, say, live there for a while. And then part of the idea of living in the house is that someday that house will be gone. It doesn't have to last forever for it to be an awesome house. And so it's very possible that people leaving Cahokia didn't think of it even as an abandonment. They just thought of it as like, okay, we're moving on to the next place. We're kind of done with this area. And you know, people, a small number of people did remain there. And when Europeans arrived, of course, the Cahokia tribe was there. So it was a very, I think there's a lot of evidence that suggests that it really wasn't a tragedy. It was that the people who lived there believed in transformation as part of everyday life, and that this was just another transformation, moving to a new place.
So it's understandably challenging for archaeologists to piece together the spiritual and cultural practices of a people that left behind no written language. But this story about Çatalhöyük has an example of mistakes that have been made. Like, early Western explorers excavating there assumed, oh, well, here we have a matriarchal culture of goddess worshippers. And it turns out they were all wrong.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, most people who've heard of Çatalhöyük, this ancient city in Turkey, have heard of these what were called goddess figurines. And they're of women who have really big bellies and breasts, and they look, you know, a little bit like what we imagine a fertility goddess would look like. They look fertile. And often they're posing with fierce animals, so they also look very strong. And so James Mellart, who was a British archaeologist who did some of the first formal excavations at Çatalhöyük, he didn't excavate very much of the city, so he had very little context for what he was finding. And he found, kind of by chance, this one house that was just packed with all of these symbolic objects, including a lot of these figurines. And he decided, because these were images of naked women that were clearly intended to be powerful, not just like, you know, the kind of women that he might have seen in, say, Playboy magazine. These were women, you know, posed with jaguars and stuff. He was like, well, it must be a goddess worshiping civilization. It must be a matriarchy, because who else would produce these kinds of images and these kinds of figurines? And now, now that we have much more of the city excavated and we can kind of understand what role these goddess figurines played in people's everyday lives, we realize that probably, I mean, archaeologists believe now that probably these figurines were more like those skulls I talked about earlier, maybe images of revered ancestors. People made them a lot. They weren't like a special figurine that you had like one of and you worshiped. Like, people made them really quickly all the time out of mud. They may have been associated with, one archaeologist said that they might be associated with like little acts of magic where you needed a one little thing to happen. So you would kind of quick make one of these figurines, call upon an honored ancestor, the magic would happen, and then you would just toss the figurine away. And they found a bunch of these so-called goddesses in trash heaps, which is another hint that maybe these weren't exactly goddesses. Maybe they served some other kind of function for people. But one thing we can say about them is that it does indicate, along with a lot of other evidence, that men and women had slightly different roles, but that they were equal roles in this city, that women had a very revered position, you know, were able to kind of, that they had positions of authority in the city as well as men.
So human beings occupied Çatalhöyük en masse for a long enough time that there were some kind of extraordinary technological changes that would revolutionize daily life between the start of that settlement and the end of it. Can you talk about some of those changes that might have like literally freed people's time up for more symbolic thinking?
Sure. A lot of these changes have to do with food preparation and eating. So one of the big shifts we see at Çatalhöyük is referred to by archaeologists working there as people cross the dairy line. And that just means that people started at a certain point in the city's history, they started cooking with milk. And that indicates a couple things. One is that they were keeping herd animals, probably goats. And so they were milking their animals. And they also were able to start digesting milk, which is something that not everyone can do. Not all populations of humans are good at digesting milk. If you've heard of lactose intolerance, that's really common in most parts of the world. So, you know, it just kind of gives you a stomach ache. But clearly the people at Çatalhöyük kind of had passed through that. They had the genetics that allowed them to metabolize milk as adults. And the other thing that they developed, which is even more cool, is fired pottery. And it sounds like, whatever, who cares about that? But it was an incredible, it was basically a development, a technological development on the order of developing steel or developing, you know, microwaves. Because once you have fired pottery, you can heat a pot over a fire and it won't crack. So that means you can pile your food into your nice fired pottery, you know, pot and put it over the fire and let it sit and simmer while you go off and do something else. And previously, cooking was a lot more labor intensive. It probably involved doing things like adding heated rocks to pots of food or just, you know, barbecuing a lot. So it really changed. It also changed the kind of food that people could eat. So it was kind of like, you know, when we think about the 1950s, when a lot of people started getting, you know, dishwashers and microwaves and people had more time to do other things besides cook all day. That's exactly what was happening at Çatalhöyük. And it made a huge, huge difference.
You met with a scholar who has found a unique way to consider an ancient city as a place filled with human beings that we could relate to if we were to actually meet them. Tell us about Dido.
Yeah, so Ruth Tringham, who is an archaeologist that spent several years excavating at Çatalhöyük, she decided that she would focus her work on one particular house because she really wanted to understand just the life of one family in the city. And one of the, of course, one of the things you can do is once you excavate the floor of a house, you can figure out who lived there because they're buried under the floor. And so when she did that, there was one skeleton, which she nicknamed Dido, which belonged to a woman who had lived into probably her 40s, which would have been very old. And there were other skeletons that were probably members of her family that had been buried alongside her. And we know that Dido led a very active life. She cracked some ribs at a certain point, and they had healed. So she had lived through that, although it probably was painful for her. And she had all kinds of, you know, items in the house when the house was abandoned that kind of gave us hints of her everyday life, including, you know, the kinds of things she would have cooked with. She was buried with a woven basket, which was quite amazing because although the basket itself had decayed, the texture on the outside of the basket had left an impression in the clay. So we could actually see the weaving on this beautiful basket that had been made from reeds. And there were also a lot of carved figurines in the house. So we think maybe Dido might have been a particular expert at making figurines of animals. And so it's a very interesting way of approaching archaeology to look just at an ordinary person in their life rather than, say, trying to find who's the king of this place or who's the great leader. Because at Çatalhöyük, we just don't know. We don't know what their political structure was. And so when we look at life there, we have to focus on the domestic. And of course, the domestic is where all the cool technology was happening, like fired pottery.
So you think, or scholars think, the demise of Çatalhöyük played out like a kind of slow motion shock. What went wrong?
So this is another big mystery. And partly that's because, as you mentioned earlier, we don't have writing from Çatalhöyük. This is a pre-writing civilization. Although I should say that civilizations that have writing, like say ancient Rome, oftentimes people lie in the writing. So sometimes it can be actually harder to figure out what's happened when you have writing because you kind of have to guess where they're lying. But what seems to have happened at Çatalhöyük is somewhat similar to what we talk about when we say that Detroit is having issues, which is that the infrastructure started to fall apart. And because the houses were built with walls that were shared, like apartments, if your neighbor leaves and their house collapses, that means your house might collapse too. So it's very hard to maintain a city like that if the population starts draining away. So there's that kind of basic problem that was happening. The other problem is very hypothetical. And some archaeologists believe that it's possible that Çatalhöyük's culture, like the people who lived there, kind of outgrew the type of urban design that they had, where at Çatalhöyük, everyone had a house that was roughly the same size. Like I said, they were all connected. So they were really up in each other's faces all the time. And as time went on, it's very likely that there was a lot of conflict over this. And we don't think that they had any kind of centralized authority. Like nobody had a castle, you know, nobody had a big place where they were kind of gathering people together. And so it's possible that there was a failure of leadership, basically, that there were certain moments in the city where people were debating and arguing and at each other's throats, and there just simply wasn't any way to resolve it because they hadn't yet invented a social system where you could manage 5,000 people. That's a lot. Like if you've gone from a village of 50 people and then you move to a place with 5,000 people, you can't really transplant kind of village politics to city politics. It's a really different beast. And so it's possible that people left because they couldn't resolve those big conflicts. And so they moved on. A lot of the people who left the city went back to village life. We know that the whole area around Çatalhöyük, once the city is abandoned, suddenly all these little tiny villages spring up all around. So it seems like it kind of broke apart like a dandelion. And, you know, people kind of went back to these smaller communities where it was a lot easier to make decisions.
Annalee, how did Angkor in Cambodia come to appear lost and therefore found by Henri Muo?
So Angkor was the capital city of the Khmer Empire, which was a huge empire that stretched across big parts of Southeast Asia, all of Cambodia, Thailand, Vietnam, Laos, and it kind of grew and shrank over time. And it was another city like Chitalhuayuk where people left pretty slowly. So oftentimes, if you read about Angkor in your textbooks, which not enough people do, you'll probably hear that the city abruptly collapsed in the 15th century when it was raided by a neighboring kingdom. But that isn't really the truth, because the fact is that Angkor was raided by neighboring kingdoms a lot. That was just kind of the norm, and it often made it through all of these invasions and kind of came out stronger. So what happened at Angkor is very scary for us to think about right now in the States, because essentially it was battered by a series of droughts and floods over time. Angkor, where it's located in Cambodia, is at the nexus of two different really intense monsoon systems, one of which makes it really rainy during the rainy season, and the other makes it really, really dry during the dry season. And so the city's kings had ordered workers had through a system of kind of indentured labor, they'd ordered workers to build these massive reservoirs and canal systems that brought water into the city during the dry months. It brought it in from the mountains, but also captured all that rainwater during the monsoon season to, fertilize fields when it got dry. So they had just this incredible sophisticated water infrastructure. And when the political leaders of the city started to have conflict and started to have basically an unstable system of political power, the first thing that got neglected really was the infrastructure. And partly that was because the kings didn't treat the labor force as well. So laborers were less interested in staying in the city and working to fix that stuff. And partly it was just bad planning, same old thing that we see today where a city or a state doesn't want to invest in, new water infrastructure. And so the infrastructure gets really run down. And in the case of Angkor, we have evidence from, looking at this ancient city's, profile over time, we can see that it was massively flooded. There's parts of the city where if you dig down, you see just a layer of silt because the whole place was inundated. And over time, that made people not want to be there. There was less economic opportunity for people. Eventually, the royal family left Angkor and fled to Phnom Penh, which they considered to be a little bit more habitable. And after the royal family left, there was even less opportunity for people. They couldn't go work in court. They couldn't kind of, there was no upward mobility for this whole group of people that had been working there as like bureaucrats and artists and all kinds of other stuff. And so basically, over a period of about 100 years, people left to either go to another city to pursue opportunities, or they went back to farming. And a lot of Angkor, if you see pictures of it, it's very overgrown with jungle. It's been turned into farmland. And so by the time that Europeans like Henri Mouhot arrived in the 19th century, what they saw looked like just a couple of temples with monks in them, and the temples were crumbling. And they didn't have the context of knowing that there had once been this massive city that is now overgrown or had been converted back to farmland, because most of the houses in this massive city of about 900,000 people had been made from perishable materials. And this is a tropical area. So, perishable materials don't last long in a tropical area. So it really wasn't until the last 10 years when scientists started using LIDAR to re-examine the location of the city that they found the remains of all these roads and all of these house foundations that showed that this had been a massive, massive city. And it wasn't lost. It was just, again, people left because it wasn't very nice to live there when everything was falling apart. So it was a very, it wasn't like barbarians at the gates at all. It was much more like infrastructure decay in the backyard.
Yeah, scholars call it a cascading network failure.
Mm-hmm. That's right, because what happens, especially when you have something like a network of canals that are helping a city survive, if you have one piece of that canal network that fails, that leads to a cascade of other failures. And in the case of Angkor, one of the things that happened was when they got into their drought years, they said, okay, I guess it'll always be drought forever. So they dug a bunch of new canals that led up to the mountains and redirected some big rivers into the city. So there was now all of this infrastructure for bringing water into the city. But then guess what happens when you have a flood year? Then suddenly just the city is just full of water, and it's this uncontrollable force that's washing away houses and things like that. So they weren't able to, you know, really adequately plan to keep that network of canals running under multiple circumstances. They were really just responding in the moment to what was happening in terms of their climate. And so, yeah, they could have really used some of the climate models that we have now, where they could sort of project, oh, we aren't actually going to need this massive water infrastructure to be built this way. If we want to last for 20 years, we need to be thinking about drought conditions and flood conditions.
One common mistake in a lot of these places seems to have been spending resources on like big bang projects rather than things that helped everyday life work better.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, we see that a lot at Angkor, where we have a lot of, you know, we have written records, and we know that certain kings at Angkor would just spend tons and tons of labor power building massive decorative water features, massive temples that didn't really serve any purpose other than to kind of glorify the king and his retinue. So, you know, we don't know if that was happening at Cahokia, where, of course, we also have these massive earthen pyramids. Clearly, those were not intended to serve like a public park purpose. They were also for kind of bolstering some kind of leadership structure. But yeah, it is a common failure mode where instead of putting people to work, building, you know, better farmland, building better dams, building better houses, better roads, you see leaders saying like, well, but if my house looks really good, that's really what's important. And, you know, it doesn't, you know, everything else will kind of fall into place. And, you know, the best kings or the most beloved kings at Angkor, for example, were ones like Jayavarman the Seventh, who is remembered not just for building a beautiful temple, but also for building as many as 100 hospitals and keeping the roads clean and keeping the canals open so that people could transit all over the empire. So that's a nice lasting legacy, building a lot of hospitals. He's still very beloved in Cambodia.
What is the takeaway from these stories you share about the adaptability and resilience of human societies in the face of change?
You know, I think ultimately what these abandoned cities show is that people are great survivors, and that, you know, when a city is left behind, what we usually see in the wake of that is this incredible scattering of that city's culture into all kinds of new places. When people leave a city, they don't just instantly stop caring about the culture that they enjoyed there. And they bring it with them to the next place. These are not places that are lost. They're places that were abandoned, and we can learn a lot from them about how to survive. And I find it so awe-inspiring in a way how much continuity there really is. You know, we don't, like I said, we like to imagine that there are all these apocalypses happening all the time because it sounds really exciting. But in fact, it's much more like we're experiencing gradual transformation with moments of really scary violence and scary conflict. But even through that, we see just much more continuity than we do disjunction.
Annalee Newitz is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, a founder of IO9 and former editor-in-chief of Gizmodo. Their new book is Four Lost Cities, A Secret History of the Urban Age. Annalee, this has been so interesting. Thank you for making time for us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Anna Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Angelica Perez, Tammy George, and Marissa Green. You can listen to Think wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.